Let's continue our look at the events that took place in the early morning hours of Friday, the 14th day of the first Jewish month. This would be the day on which all the Passover lambs have to be butchered. The arrest party has brought Jesus from the Garden of Gethsemane to the residence of the high priest Caiaphas, which is located on the western hill of the city of Jerusalem, the high city, which is the rich part of town. There are some claims to certain places where it might have been in that general vicinity, but nothing clearly identified just yet by archaeology. But Jesus has been brought here probably around 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. He is in this complex on an upper level. We know that because we've talked about how Peter is in the courtyard below, and he's already gone through a couple of incidents of denying that he even knows who Jesus is. In Jesus arriving at the complex, he was first interviewed by Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Annas is the godfather, if you will, of the high priestly families. And so he gets first crack at Jesus, but gets nothing out of him. And so we know that Jesus was then conducted from that private interview with Annas to the room in the complex where a quorum of the Sanhedrin has gathered. And so by the time we get to this, it's probably 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I want to read to you from Mark chapter number 14, verse number 55, which tells us about this gathering. It says, now the chief priests, so that's the leading families amongst the priests, and the whole council, that's the Sanhedrin. It's made up of 70 members, and it's a mixture between the Pharisees who believe in religious things and Sadducees who don't. And so the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. So their common goal, regardless of their feelings toward religion, is to get rid of this Jesus character that's causing trouble, who's challenging us, and possibly even riling the people up in such a way that there may be need for the Romans to come in and put down a riot. And if that happens, we know that the Roman way is to often get rid of the leaders that couldn't control the people. So these Sadducees and Pharisees on the council have a common goal to keep their positions of authority by getting rid of Jesus. But they're running into a problem. Because in a way that really confuses us, I think, in our thinking about the Pharisees and the Sadducees at this preliminary hearing, they feel the need, they feel compelled to keep all their rules and regulations for a trial. So that is why they're meeting now at the residence in the wee hours of the morning in preliminary hearing style. This is not the official trial. The official trial will take place once the sun rises and once this group has convened officially at the council chamber on the Temple Mount. That's the only place and the only time that a conviction death can be handed down, because they can't do it during the hours of darkness. But what they're doing is they're trying to get all their ducks in a row, trying to get all the things ready to go so that when they walk into that chamber after the sun is up, they can go boom, 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 and finish the procedure immediately and then take Jesus to the Romans and ask them to execute him because they have to follow that step according to Roman law. The Jewish people do not have the right for capital punishment except under very specific cases that happen on the Temple Mount. All right, so they're running into a problem because their witnesses are not providing the testimony they need. Verse number 56, Mark explains, "For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. Some stood up and they bore false witness against him, saying, 'We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands.'" Now, there's a problem with that. That is actually a reference to something Jesus said back in John chapter 2, the very first Passover of his ministry, 3 years earlier, when he had been challenged by the leadership for casting the money changers out of the temple. They said, "By what right, by what authority do you do these things?" And Jesus says to them, and this is the exact quote, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." John goes on in his commentary of that passage saying, "He spoke these words not of the temple building, but about the temple of his body." So that was among the first predictions by Jesus about his death and resurrection. But what do we have here? We have witnesses that apparently were there that day saying, "I heard him say that he's going to destroy the temple, and then he's going to build it up again in 3 days." Now, that is not what Jesus said. And apparently, they had several of these witnesses that were there that day, but they can't even make the exact same quote about what they believe Jesus said. For just look at verse 59. "Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree." Now, this gets to the sticking point that I mentioned earlier. These Pharisees in particular feel they must follow the exact rules. So they can't put words in the mouths of these witnesses. That would be wrong. And the wording has to be exactly in agreement between at least two of these witnesses, because the scripture says, "By the mouth of two or three witnesses, let every matter be established." So if the wording is not exactly the same between these witnesses, they can't convict. This takes us over to Matthew 26, I think. Matthew 26, let's read verse 59 because it's kind of helping us see the parallel. "Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death." Now they were actually seeking testimony in agreement, but what they're getting is non-agreeing testimony, false, inaccurate testimony. But they found none that would help them, though many witnesses came forward. So that was the point of this preliminary hearing, is to filter through a whole bunch of witnesses that they've gathered together to see if they can find at least two they can agree on a statement from Jesus' mouth that they can convict him as a capital criminal, someone that needs to be executed. Verse 60 continues in the Matthew 26. "At last, two came forward and said, 'This man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.' But as we already heard, the two witnesses don't agree in the exact quote, in the exact wording. So it doesn't help them out. They can't secure a conviction by this non-agreed testimony. So the high priest, that's Caiaphas, is very frustrated by this. And so he said, it says here that he stood up and he said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" So the Jewish law allows for a person to incriminate themselves. They didn't really have anything like the Fifth Amendment sort of protection, I suppose. So they demand of him, "What do you have to say for yourself? You're hearing all this testimony. Say something." But at first, it says here, verse 63, Jesus remained silent. So he chooses to invoke what we would refer to as Fifth Amendment. "I have the right to remain silent." So he remains silent. And then the high priest pulls this little tool out of his judge bag. The high priest said to him, "I adjure you," "I order you, by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." So he effectively says, "You have a responsibility to answer this question in the face of God from the high priest of God." And so this is a demand that expects a response. And so Jesus does. Now keep in mind, everything else they've tried has not worked. So this is a last recourse ploy. But Jesus does provide them with what they were looking for. Jesus said to him, "You have said so." The Mark account, Jesus said, "I am." And you remember that is tied in to the Exodus chapter 3 passage where God gives his name to Moses. "I am whom I am." So that phrase has repercussions to it, especially in this context here. They just asked him, "Are you Christos? Are you Mashiach? Are you the Messiah? But also, are you the Son of God? Are you claiming some sort of special relationship to the Father?" They've actually been concerned about that earlier, and they've even tried to stone him in the temple complex a couple of times when he made that claim. One of them, recorded in the Gospel of John, was, "Before Abraham was, I am." And they tried to stone him because of that claim. And so here, Jesus opens up his mouth and says, "Yes, I am." And not only that, look what else he says. I'm in the Matthew 26 passage, verse 24, continuing. "But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Now that is a reference back to Daniel. The vision of the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man who was presented before him. This is chapter number 7. It is clearly taken to be a messianic passage, the Son of Man equivalent to the Messiah. And it says in that passage that he is coming with the clouds of glory, clouds of heaven. And so it is a portrayal of the Messiah arriving in his majesty and glory and this divine background. And so this is exactly what Caiaphas was looking for. Verse 65, "Then the high priest tore his robes." This is a sign going way back in Jewish tradition of extreme grief Clothing was considered to be very valuable. Sometimes it was even passed from generation to generation. And for you to rip your clothing was to show your absolute disregard for its value, that what is happening at this moment is so much bigger than the value of that clothing. So he makes a big deal of ripping his clothing to show how taken aback he is at what was just said in his presence. He then said, he has uttered blasphemy. Blasphemy is slander, specifically saying something that is not true about someone else or about yourself. And there is a special classification of blasphemy where you have said something untrue about God. And that is a capital crime, bearing false witness about or against God. And that's exactly what they were hoping for. From his own mouth, he's committed blasphemy. Now we, looking at this, would say, but he didn't commit blasphemy. He spoke the truth. Because he is God. He is the I Am. He is the Messiah. He is the Son of Man of prophecy. But that doesn't matter to these guys here because they don't believe that. So they are convinced that the moment he uttered those words, he committed a capital crime. And listen further. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. You've heard it from his own lips, basically. He wants to know, what's your judgment? He just said the preliminary hearing is finished. Effectively, I think we have what we need, gentlemen. What do you think? Verse 66, what is your judgment? They answered, he deserves death. He is guilty of a capital crime. And now Jesus' status changes. He has now been, in a preliminary hearing, found guilty by words from his own mouth. So it's only a matter of technical course to go to the council chamber after the sun has risen up and go through the motions to condemn him. So for all practical purposes, he is a dead man walking. And because of that, he can now be beaten. He can now be treated roughly, harshly, and in a way that they feel befits his crime of blasphemy. And so Matthew goes on to tell us this. Matthew 26:67, then they spit in his face and struck him, and some slapped him, saying, prophesy to us, you Christ, who is it that struck you? The Mark account, Mark 14:65. Some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, prophesy. And the guards received him with blows. Again, these are the temple police, part of the arrest party, no doubt. And so they now feel free to abuse this man that will be killed later this day, because in their mind, he is an ultimate criminal in the Jewish society. He is a blasphemer of God. Luke 22:63. Now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him as they beat him. They also blindfolded him, and they kept asking him, prophesy, who is it that struck you? And they said many other things against him, blaspheming him. So now they are the ones slandering him, according to the reality that he is in fact the I Am. He is the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. He is the incarnate Christ. He is the Son of Man, the Son of God. And he is also something else that I'd like to point out here. He is the suffering servant of the Isaiah passages. I want to go to Isaiah 53 because this has things to say about what's going on right now at the hands of this Jewish leadership, this Jewish council, now that they have condemned him in the preliminary hearing, that are described well ahead of time, you know, almost 800 years previous in the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah 53, verse 1. Who has believed what they heard from us? To whom has the arm of he who has been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. This is a reference to the Messiah, that he started as a baby and grew up like a young plant, which is interesting because remember one of the names for Jesus is the Nazarene. Nazarene comes from the city of Nazareth or Nazareth, which means branches or sprig that grows up from the ground. So Jesus, the Nazarene, grew up in front of God, and this is what we know about him. Verse 2, he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. So he was an ordinary-looking person. That's what the scripture says right here. And then this is what happened to him. Verse 3, he was despised and rejected by men. That just happened. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised and we esteemed him not. So he's now being treated like a criminal. He is a shameful figure. Verse 4, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. That's the prophetic part of it, that what's happening here is part of the atonement. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. So it was thought at this moment, in that room, in that complex, that Jesus is getting what's coming to him. When the reality is, he's getting what's coming to us, the sinners. Verse 5, but he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. Peter will talk about this in his letter, that the beatings Jesus took and his crucifixion became the source of our spiritual healing. This is the beginning of Jesus' atonement process. This preliminary hearing, the beating that he's taking right now, the mocking that is happening to him right now, is just the beginning of what will continue throughout this day. Verse 6, all we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned every one to his own way, and he who is has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Therefore, we see the God of the universe allowing all of these things to happen to himself because it is what is necessary to save our souls. This is the heart of the gospel, that God loved us in this fashion, that Christ would lay down his life for us. Now, while all this is wrapping up, we need to return to the final incident of denial by Peter. Remember, he's down below in the courtyard, hanging out, waiting to see how this turns out. And two incidents have already happened. Here's the third. Let me read to you from Matthew 26, 73. After a little while, and it's actually about an hour apparently, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, certainly you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you. The John passage seems to indicate that one of the people in this group was a relative of the guy that Peter had chopped the ear off of, Malchus. And so now they're saying, we know you've got to be one of his followers because he's Jesus of Nazareth. He's the Galilean, and you've got a Galilean accent. And then he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear. Now, he's not foul-mouthed. What he is saying is, I swear by God. I swear by the name. I swear by heaven. I swear by all that is holy that I don't know this man. I don't know what you're talking about. And then we are told, specifically in the Mark passage, immediately after he said those words, a rooster crowed a second time. But not just that. Luke tells us something that happened at this moment that I believe is more significant than even the second crowing of the rooster. Luke 22:61. It says, right after talking about the rooster, the Lord turned and looked at Peter. At this moment, apparently, Jesus was being moved from point A to point B, possibly they were getting ready to leave the complex to take him to the official hearing room, the council chamber down on the Temple Mount. So he's probably very beaten up, bruised, bloodied. And it says that the Lord turned and looked at Peter the moment after the rooster crowed. And he looked him right in the face. And it says here, Peter then remembered the saying of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times. And then all of the Gospels that mention this story say, and Peter went out and he wept bitterly, because he had done exactly what he swore he would never do. He denied the Lord three times. But there's good news coming for Peter yet.